Hello, and welcome back. On today's episode, we're going to dive into the past, present, and future of America's sordid relationship with race. We've got important moving talks by two guests. Each has been called a voice of conscience in our nation. Brian Stevenson, champion of human rights and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, and John Hope Franklin, the towering historian who died in 2009 at the age of 94. Their talks, which you're about to hear, are as pressing today as the day they were given, perhaps more so. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement.
Academy, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
As the great historian John Hope Franklin once wrote, if the house is to be set in order, one cannot begin with the present. He must begin with the past. John Hope Franklin devoted his life to telling the truth about America's past. He refused to let the whitewashed, inconvenient version of our nation's story stand. Where there were gaping holes in the history books, erasing the experience and the role of African Americans, he filled them in. He literally helped create the field of African American history, beginning with his groundbreaking book in 1947, From Slavery to Freedom, A History of African Americans. That was the very first book Brian Stevenson bought with his own money, as he once told historian and former president of Harvard, Drew Gilpin Faust. He had to save up to purchase the book, and it opened his eyes. We'll return to Stevenson's story, but first, let's listen to the talk John Hope Franklin gave at the Academy of Achievement's 1996 summit. Franklin noted on his way to the podium that he had to borrow $500 from his mentor to pay for his first year of graduate school at Harvard, a detail he'll refer back to in a moment.
As Langston Hughes said, life ain't been no crystal stair. And as I look up at that statement about the American dream, part of my work has been to keep it from being the American nightmare. When I graduated from Fisk University in 1935 and had applied to Harvard University to do graduate work, one of the reasons I did so is that I couldn't go to the graduate school in the state in which I was born and the state in which my father paid taxes, the state of Oklahoma. And so I had to exile myself to Harvard. And before I got there, I had to take a scholastic aptitude test. And so I went over to Vanderbilt to take it. And one doesn't have all the savoir-faire that he might have at the age of 20. And so when the professor at Vanderbilt, who was administering the examination, threw the examination at me as I sat to take it, I can have no doubt that I flunked it. And Harvard University admitted me without any financial aid, and there was no bidding of one college against another, of one university against another, as is the custom these days. That's why I had to borrow the money for my father, of course, being a lawyer in a town where all of his clients were black and where 95% or more of them were unemployed in 1931, and where we had lost our home, we didn't have any money. So I went on to Harvard, and I worked there, used that $500 to the best advantage, and proceeded to work, taking in typing and washing dishes for my evening meal, and making enough grades so that from that year on, I didn't have any financial worries. Indeed, I was in the lending money business for a while, giving with shaving some income, interest, so that my colleagues who were not as financially able as I could make it. I found Harvard University not very exciting or not very difficult. And in due course, I completed my work and left to write my dissertation. And I went to North Carolina to do my dissertation on the free Negroes in North Carolina. And when I presented myself at the archives, I found that when they built the archives, they had made no provision, as the director said to me, that any blacks would ever come, so he had no place for me to do the research. He said, but I will see if I can do something for you. He said, come back in a week. And I said nothing. I just looked at him. He said, what about 3 days then? I said, I'll be back. And 3 days later, he had arranged a little room out of which he had taken some exhibit material and placed a table and a chair. And there I did my research for my doctoral dissertation. He gave me a key to these stacks, too, because he said that no white page would want to bring any material to me. And so he gave me a key, and I would go through the search room to the stacks and load up my wagon with all of this wonderful material and roll it back through the search room where the white researchers were using that one folder that they were allowed at a time. And so in 2 weeks' time, he said to me, I'll have to take your key away from you. I said, I knew something, I had done something wrong. He said, I've had a great protest from the white researchers who said that they are being discriminated against, that they don't have the same privilege that you do. And since I can't give all of them keys, I have to take yours, and you have to content yourself by being waited upon by the white pages. With that experience, I began my research in the South. I went from there later to the state of Alabama, where I did research. And from there, in the summer of 1945, I did research at the State Archives in Louisiana. And the only reason I was able to do research in the State Archives in Louisiana was that the day I arrived, the archives had closed to celebrate the end of World War II, the end where victory had been achieved over evil. And all of the Louisiana citizens were celebrating. And the archives were closed. And the archivist, who didn't care about my doing research there, invited me to do research while it was closed and while Louisianans were celebrating the great victory. And so I was able in that way to complete my research on my second book, which was on the militant South. Interestingly enough, when that book was submitted to the Harvard University Press for publication, there was a great furor among the historical profession with respect to the temerity of an African-American to write about white people. That correspondence is in the Huntington Library, and I will review it as I write my autobiography within a few months or years. The Crystal Stairs, you see, were not really very good all of the time. But just the same, I was able, with some fortitude and some encouragement from my parents and from my dear wife, who was my college classmate and my helpmate and who had financed on her own the research for me, the period of research that I, in which I did the book From Slavery to Freedom, these people encouraged me and helped me, and above all, Theodore Curry, to whom we have already referred. And he lived long enough to see me make some mark in the historical profession, where I had become the president of the American Historical Association, the president of the Organization of American Historians, the president of the American Historical Association, and president, the national president of Phi Beta Kappa, all of that I achieved before he died in 1979. Now, you made reference to the fact that I have been among the most honored scholars in this country, and I wear that mantle with some humility. I also want to observe that whereas there has been this bright side, there's also been a side which is not reflective of the best in America. When I went to Brooklyn College as the chair of the department, and with such a, which was such a spectacular appointment, that my picture and my salary were published on the front page of the New York Times, I was unable to convince 36 real estate dealers in this town, in the borough of Brooklyn, that I should purchase a home near Brooklyn College. Later, when I sought to get a loan from the banks of New York, there was not one bank in the city of New York that would admit, that would grant me a loan to purchase the home that I had found out on my own and not through any real estate dealer. And later still, when my own English godchild moved to Brooklyn and took up residence there in the home of another family, and she told this family about my, about her godfather, of whom she was very proud, the family told her that if she ever had the nerve to bring her godfather to that house, that she would have to leave at the same time. Things, though, are getting better. We spoke of the optimism this morning, of how important it was to be optimistic, and it is imperative to be optimistic. It is also very difficult to be optimistic in the face of the experiences that I've had, even in the last few months. On the night before I received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in September of 1995, I was giving a dinner party at my club in Washington, the Cosmos Club. I thought I looked fairly good. I had on a new suit, and I had a new tie, and I was coming down the grand staircase, and it is a grand staircase at the Cosmos Club, and my picture hangs on the wall in the Cosmos Club because I was the winner of the Cosmos Club Award in 94, and when I approached the bottom of the stairs, a white woman said to me, "You will get my coat for me," and handed me, or sought to hand to me, my her check. And I said, "Madam, if you will speak to one of the uniformed attendants at this club, and all of them are uniformed, perhaps you may be able to get your coat." A few months later, in March of 1996, I was in the lobby of the Waterford Hotel in Oklahoma City, waiting for the manager of one of the leading bookstores of the city, who was going to pick me up from the lobby and take me to lunch and then to an autograph party at his bookstore, where I was autographing several of my own books. And while I waited for him, a man walked up to me and said, "You get my car," and handed me my key, handed me his keys. And I said, "I'm a guest in this hotel, just as you are." I said, and I walked away from him. I had begun to wonder if I, reaching the age of 81, still had such a youthful look that I could be mistaken for an employee. And then I remember that for some, all African Americans, regardless of age, are still boys. 6 weeks ago, I was at the St. Moritz Hotel on Central Park South, where I was staying, and a woman, I was waiting in the lobby for Tony Drexel Duke, an old friend and one of the descendants of the founders of Duke University, where I am the James B. Duke Professor of History Emeritus. But before Tony arrived, a woman walked up to me and said, "Look, here's some trash for you. I can't find the trash basket, and you just put it in the trash yourself." I said, "I'm neither the trash nor the trash basket, madam, and you'll have to find it yourself." What I was suggesting to her was that somehow she had mistaken me for somebody that I was not. Life is still no crystal stair. And although one must continue to be a great and perennial and sometimes blind optimist, one must also recognize the realities of a community that is not at all colorblind. I appeal to you, young people, as you go about your many exciting duties in the future, that you try to make this country colorblind. And until it is colorblind, and we are far from it, would you crown your own work with the kind of mercy and understanding and sense of justice that all Americans are entitled to. Thank you.
Bryan Stevenson was not there on that day in 1996 when John Hope Franklin implored the young delegates at the Academy of Achievement Summit to commit themselves to mercy and to justice. But Stevenson was actually a delegate to an Academy of Achievement Summit 20 years earlier when he was a high school student. And it would be hard to find someone who has spent more of his life dedicated to carrying out John Hope Franklin's vision. In fact, Bryan Stevenson's memoir and the movie that was recently inspired by it is called Just Mercy. It tells the story of Stevenson's work as a lawyer on behalf of innocent men and women on death row and on behalf of children sentenced to life in prison or death. Stevenson is also the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, and he's behind the Legacy Museum and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, which explore the connections between slavery and lynching and mass incarceration. He returned to the Academy of Achievement Summit in 2019 as a featured, celebrated speaker.
Well, thank you so much. It is really an honor for me to be here and actually quite moving. As was indicated, I grew up in a poor, rural, racially segregated community. I started my education in a colored school. They did not let black children attend the public school when I started my education. There were no high schools for black kids when my dad was a teenager, so he could not go to high school. And then lawyers came into our community and, relying on the Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus Board of Education, made them open up the public schools. And because of that intervention, because those lawyers came into our community, I got to go to high school. And because I was in high school, I had the opportunity to participate in speaking events and other opportunities. And as a result of that, when I was 16, for the first time in my life, I left my little community and I got on a plane for the first time. And I came to the academy. And that's where I met these extraordinary people, full of creativity, full of dedication, full of ideas. It was a world I didn't even know existed. And I was so stimulated by that time that I got into some other contests the next year and came back the second time. And it motivated me to do things I would not have done. That was when I resolved I'm going to go to college, even though it wasn't clear how that would be possible. And I got to college and I had this amazing experience. I majored in philosophy, and I was just enjoying college, and I got to my senior year, and because nobody in my family had gone to college, I didn't know, but everybody here knows, I didn't know if you were to figure out how to stay in school and go to graduate school. I looked into history and English and political science, and I didn't know that if you want to get into graduate school in those areas, history, English, or political science, you have to know something about history, English, or political science. I was very intimidated by that, so I kept looking, and to be honest, that's how I found my way to law school. It was very clear to me, you don't need to know anything to go to law school. But I signed up for that, and I began thinking about how it was the law that created the opportunity for me to do what I do. And when I finished, I felt a calling to work for the poor and the accused and the condemned. I was worried about the emergence of what I believe it was our era characterized by the politics of fear and anger. We had politicians that were arguing to us, be afraid and be angry. And I was concerned that if we allowed ourselves to be governed by fear and anger, we would tolerate things that we shouldn't tolerate. I actually believe that fear and anger are the essential ingredients of oppression and injustice. If you go anywhere in the world where people are being abused and mistreated, if you ask the abusers why they do what they do, they'll give you a narrative of fear and anger that just seemed to be this complete disregard for the rights of people who were falling down. We declared a misguided war on drugs. We said that people who are drug addicted and drug dependent are criminals, and we began putting them in jails and prisons by the thousands, the hundreds of thousands. Our prison population went from about 300,000 in 1972 to 2.2 million. Today, we became the nation with the highest rate of incarceration in the world. We put children in adult jails and prisons. I've represented 9- and 10-year-old kids facing 60-year prison sentences because we have 13 states with no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. And I was really worried about these things. I was worried about what was happening to women. 646% increase in the number of women being sent to jails and prisons. The 6 million people now on probation and parole. And then I read this statistic from the Bureau of Justice that forecasts that 1 in 3 black male babies born in this country is expected to go to jail or prison. The statistic for Latino boys was 1 in 6, and it didn't seem like anybody was talking about that. And so I was resolved to stand with the condemned and the incarcerated. And for the last 35 years, I've tried to advocate for them. And what I've learned from that is that to do justice, there are things that we have to do. And if anything, the Academy helped me formulate this. I'm persuaded that to change the world, to create justice, we all have to find ways to get closer to people who are suffering, to get closer to people who are excluded, to get closer to the poor and the neglected. I really believe in the power of proximity. I think we can't actually do the things we want to do. It was stimulating for me to be in a room with scientists, because scientists model this idea that to have breakthroughs, to innovate, you have to be so intimate with the subject and the topic that you're studying that you can perhaps see something that no one else can see. I think justice works the same way. Many of us have been taught to stay away from the bad parts of town. I believe we have to do the opposite. We've got to get closer to the marginalized and the excluded. And I learned about proximity from my grandmother. My grandmother was this amazing woman who was the daughter of people who were enslaved. And she had these remarkable qualities. She was tough, she was strong, she was kind, she was loving, she was a force of nature in our family. My grandmother was the end of every argument in our family. She was also the start of a lot of arguments in our family. And when integration came to our community, she was so worried, she started doing this thing where she would give me hugs. And she'd squeeze me so tightly, I thought she was trying to hurt me. And then she'd see me an hour later and she'd say, "Brian, do you still feel me hugging you?" And if I said no, she would jump on me again. So by the time I was done, I figured out, and every time I would see my grandmother, I'd say, "Mama, I always feel you hugging me." And she'd smile this smile. I didn't really appreciate what she was doing until much later. She worked as a domestic her whole life. She lived into her 90s, but when she got in her 90s, she fell one day and she broke her hip. And then she was diagnosed with cancer. And I was a college student at the time, and I remember going to see my grandmother, just being heartbroken, because I couldn't imagine a world without her. And I was sitting near her, I was holding her hand, I was saying all these things, her eyes were closed. I wasn't even sure she could hear what I was saying, but I was just pouring my heart out. And finally, it was time for me to leave. And I stood up and I was about to walk away, and that's when my grandmother squeezed my hand and she opened her eyes and she looked at me. And the last thing she said to me, she said, "Brian, do you still feel me hugging you?" And then she said, I want you to know I'm always going to be hugging you. And there have been times in my life when I have felt the embrace of that woman. And for me, proximity means that when we get close enough to the poor and the excluded and the incarcerated and the disfavored and those who are hated, we can do, if nothing else, the one simple thing that I believe is key to creating human rights in the world. We can get close enough to people and wrap our arms around them and affirm their dignity and their humanity. And it seems silly, but I am persuaded that that's the way we begin to create justice. I'm also persuaded that we have to change the narratives that are out there that undermine our commitments to the rule of law, our commitment to fairness. We've built a museum and a memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, because I think the narrative about race has to change. I don't think we're free in this country. I think we're burdened by our history of racial inequality that's created a kind of smog in the air, and it doesn't matter where you go, you're breathing in this polluted air created by our long history of racial inequality that we haven't addressed. We are a post-genocide society. What we did to Native people when Europeans came here was a genocide, but we didn't call it that. And we created this narrative that Native people are savages, and that created this narrative that led us to tolerate slavery for 2.5 centuries. And I think the great evil of American slavery wasn't the bondage and the involuntary servitude. I think it was the narrative we created that Black people aren't the same as white people. They're not as good as white people. They can't do this, they can't do that. And we never confronted that narrative. We passed a 13th Amendment that talks about ending involuntary servitude, but it doesn't say anything about ending that narrative of racial difference. And it's why I've argued slavery didn't end in 1865. It just evolved. It turned into a century where Black people were lynched, pulled out of their homes, mutilated, and we didn't talk about it. Our legal systems failed us, and it created a kind of trauma. Older people of color come up to me sometimes. They say they get angry when they hear people talking about how we're dealing with domestic terrorism for the first time in our nation's history after 9/11. They said, we grew up with terror. We had to worry about being bombed and lynched and menaced every day of our lives. And the demographic geography of this nation was shaped by terror, and we haven't talked about it. The Black people in Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and Los Angeles didn't go there as immigrants. They went there as refugees and exiles from terror in the American South when 6 million people fled, gave up their land and their opportunities. And today we have these wealth gaps, and we are still dealing with this narrative because it doesn't matter if you're an Academy recipient. It doesn't matter how successful you are. You can be a PhD. You can be a leading lawyer, a leading physician. But if you're Black or brown, you will go places in this country where you're going to have to navigate a presumption of dangerousness and guilt. And I'm old enough to now tell you that it's getting exhausting to constantly have to navigate. And so I want us to get to something better. And for me, that's narrative work. I see what's happened in South Africa and Rwanda after they experienced horrific human rights violations in Germany. In Berlin, you can't go 200 meters without seeing a marker or a stone placed next to the home of a family of Jewish people who were abducted during the Holocaust. The Germans want you to go to the Holocaust Memorial because they're trying to change the narrative. They don't want to be thought of as fascists and Nazis. There are no Adolf Hitler statues in Germany, but in this country, we haven't done that. And so I believe we need an era of truth and justice, and we've opened these sites in Montgomery, and I invite you all to come to participate in this narrative work. Next, I believe that we have to stay hopeful. That's been my challenge and been my calling. I believe that hopelessness is the enemy of justice, that injustice prevails where hopelessness persists. And when we allow ourselves to be hopeless about what we can do, when we don't accept that we have to believe things we haven't seen, we accept things we should never accept. I'm persuaded that hope is our superpower. It's what enables me sometimes to stand up when other people say sit down, to speak when other people say be quiet. I think it's critical. And finally, I am persuaded that justice work, the kind of work that I do, requires me to do things that are sometimes uncomfortable and inconvenient. I think it's the same requirement for you. I don't think we can change the world if we're unwilling to do the hard things, to do the uncomfortable and inconvenient things. I'll end with this. I was taught by a man. I was giving a talk in a church, and an older Black man came into the church. He was in a wheelchair, and he was sitting in the back of the church, and he was staring at me, and had this kind of angry look on his face. I couldn't figure out, why is he looking at me so sternly? And I got through my talk, and people came up. They were very nice and appropriate. But that older Black man kept sitting in the back with that stern look on his face. And finally, when everybody else walked away, this older man wheeled himself to the front of the church. And when he got in front of me, he put his hand up. He said, "Do you know what you're doing?" And I just stood there. And then he asked me again. He said, "Do you know what you're doing?" And I mumbled something. I don't even remember what I said. Then he asked me one last time. He said, "Do you know what you're doing?" And that's when that man looked at me. He says, "I'm going to tell you what you're doing." And the man looked at me and he said, "You're beating the drum for justice. You keep beating the drum for justice." And I was so moved. I was also really relieved because I just didn't know what was about to happen. And then this man grabbed me by my jacket and he pulled me into his wheelchair. He said, come here, I'm going to show you something. And this man turned his head. He said, "You see this scar right here?" He says, "I got that scar in 1963 in Greene County trying to register people to vote." He turned his head. He said, "You see this cut I have down here at the bottom of my neck? Got that cut in Philadelphia, Mississippi, 1964, trying to register people to vote." He turned his head. He said, "You see this dark spot?" He said, "That's my bruise. Got my bruise in Birmingham, 1965, trying to register people to vote." And that's when this man looked at me. He said, "I'm going to tell you something, young man." He said, "People look at me, they think I'm some old man sitting in a wheelchair covered with cuts and bruises and scars." He said, "But I'm going to tell you something." He said, "These are not my cuts." He said, "These are not my scars." He said, "These are not my bruises." He said, "These are my medals of honor." I think we honor what it means to do justice work, but we sometimes position ourselves in difficult places. I believe really simple things. I believe that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I think if someone tells a lie, they're not just a liar. I think even if someone kills someone, they're not just a killer. And justice requires that we understand the other things they are before we judge them. I am persuaded that the opposite of poverty isn't wealth. Sometimes I think we talk too much about money. I am persuaded that the opposite of poverty is justice. And when we do justice, we deconstruct the conditions and systems and structures that sustain inequality and poverty. And finally, I believe that this is a wonderful institution because it inspired a poor black kid from the rural South to dream dreams big enough that he could one day be invited back. And I cannot tell you how meaningful that is. I cannot tell you how grateful I am for that. But mostly, I cannot tell you how excited I am to be a part of a community of people like you who I hope will find ways to get proximate, change narratives, stay hopeful, and do uncomfortable things. Thank you all very, very much.
Brian Stevenson, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative and author of Just Mercy. We heard earlier from the preeminent American historian, John Hope Franklin. When he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, President Bill Clinton called him a moral compass for America. This is Alice Winkler, and you've been listening to What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Thanks to the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation for funding What It Takes, and thanks to you for listening.